Okay, I think maybe we'll begin. I have some introductory information to provide, and I'll get started on that. And as people sign on, eventually I think we'll probably have everybody online by the time I'm through with a few of my introductory comments. The first thing that I would like to say is welcome everyone to the engagement, the second of our of six engagement and learning telelearning sessions. They're being sponsored by the Canadian Social Economy Hub and the Steering Committee for the 2010 National Summit on a People-Centered Economy. This very important request that's going out to you right now, and that would be that everyone please use star 6 to mute their telephone, unless and to not open that up until you have a question that you would like to pose, and that way we can reduce all of the background noise and make this as good as possible in terms of sound quality. So again, the way to mute your line is star 6, and if you want to unmute it, you just have to do star 6 again. My name is Lou Hammond-Kettleson. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Cooperatives at the University of Saskatchewan, and I'm also the director of the Northern Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan Social Economy Regional Node. We've been working in our region now for the past 5 years, the results of the research is coming out on a regular basis. The Canadian Social Economy Hub is our national coordinating body, and we're very grateful to the work that's been done by Ian and Rupert and Annie to facilitate the work of all of the regions. The Social Economy Research Program is being co-led by the University of Victoria with Ian McPherson at its head and the Canadian CED Network, initially Rupert and then Mike Toy, who's taken over and replacing Rupert as the lead there. It involves practitioner organizations and universities across Canada with a national hub and 6 regional centers in different parts of the country, with funding from the federal government through the Social Science and Humanities Research Council. The research is being undertaken to understand how the approaches of the social economy can be better understood and effectively applied so that community organizations, civil society, community developers, and researchers can collaborate to empower groups and communities to meet their social and economic needs. Our session today is based on 2 papers under the theme of procurement. The first one, authored by Daryl Reed and J.J. McMurtry and presented by J.J. McMurtry, is called The CSERP Knowledge Mobilization. The second paper, authored by David LePage and presented by David, is the National Summit issue paper called Organizing the Social Economy Marketplace. One other thing just to remind you of right now, you can go at any time to the issue paper wiki, and this link was provided with your dial-in information. And by going to this link, then you can contribute your comments and feedback on the paper just as quickly as you want to. So this is something you could be doing at the same time as you're listening. The revised papers will then be presented at the National Summit Forum, where a common declaration and action plan will be developed. Many of you are, if not already in the chat room, are trying to get into the chat room. This is a mechanism that's available to you to ask questions as the presenters are doing, providing their making their presentations. If you don't have access to the chat room, there will be an opportunity to propose your question following the brief discussion of the questions that are in the chat room. I guess that's probably all that I wanted to say just in terms of introductory remarks. And so now I would like to turn to our first speaker, J.J. McMurtry. J.J. is the coordinator of the Business and Society Program at York University.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Lou. So I'm presenting a paper that I'm co-authoring with Daryl Reed from the Business and Society Program. and it's based at York University, and it's based on some research that we were doing out of the Southern Ontario node on procurement. And what we've tried to do is take our research on procurement and expand it to discuss the role that procurement can play in a people-centered economy, but we've taken a sort of an academic and historical approach to understanding how procurement happens within the social economy. So importantly, it starts off with practical research, then we go to sort of a literature review and an understanding of the history of procurement, then into a discussion about economics and economic value, and then into, again, practical solutions. So I also wanted to apologize. This paper is still in draft form. We are finishing up our research, which I'll explain to you in a second, and the final paper will be available, as Lou said, at the event, at Ottawa. So I'm going to start by talking about the research that Daryl and I have been involved in. And essentially, we're looking at procurement policies for three publicly funded organizations at the sub-provincial level, municipalities, school boards, and universities. And this was across Canada, although we were not so successful in getting responses from Quebec. And we were more successful getting responses from universities than we were from school boards, and more successful in getting responses from school boards than we were from municipalities. But what we were trying to do is do two things. We were trying to identify or map what kind of procurement policies exist in these organizations, and we were specifically trying to trace four different types. Everybody has a basic procurement policy. We wanted to know if there was an environmental procurement policy, or what we call sustainable. We wanted to know if there was an ethical procurement policy, which looked at labor practices, things like no sweat. And then finally, whether or not there was a fair trade procurement policy. So we're mapping those three types of organizations across the country and those types of procurement policies. But we were also trying to map, importantly, what kind of values were driving and what kind of processes were driving the development of these procurement policies. And importantly, asking the question, why haven't procurement policies been developed further? Because we knew that, for example, fair trade and ethical procurement policies are not fully developed in all of those organizations. So one of the things we experienced was the difficulty of doing this kind of survey across the country, and not just because there's so many different school boards and universities and municipalities, but rather that there was a lack of a central organization that was effective in terms of getting us access to those organizations. And this led us to one of the discoveries of the research, which is that purchasing is actually enormously siloed inside of organizations. And I'll give you the example of my own university at York to give you an idea of this, but at York University, purchasing doesn't happen centrally. It happens by college, it happens by business type, it happens in different areas. Whoa. Different areas of the university differently, and most importantly, none of those people really talk to each other. So sourcing something as simple as fair trade coffee inside of a university context is not very easy. The other finding that we had was that the role of suppliers in determining what in the paper we call the vista of possibilities of procurement is enormous, so that because of the siloed effect of purchasing, both internal to an organization and across the country by sector, the suppliers really determine the ability of an organization to access particular goods, and what's more important for the social economy or the people-centered economy is they control access to those organizations that are producing more ethical or more socially based goods, and that's a huge problem which needs to be overcome. What we also found is that two interesting findings, one in Ontario specifically around the environment, with the introduction of the Green Energy Act, public policy has an enormous effect on developing, because our research has gone over 5 years, the changing climate of purchasing policy managers in thinking about whether or not you should develop a sustainable purchasing policy has just changed enormously, specifically in Ontario and to a lesser extent in BC, where provincial governments have taken this on as a mandate. And so that was something we found to be quite interesting and perhaps not surprising, but important when we're thinking about developing more progressive procurement policies. Second is that the role of other people-centered economy, if you want, or social economy organizations such as unions, for example, was quite minor in the development of purchasing policies in these sub-provincial areas we were looking at. But stakeholder pressure generally, however that's constructed, is enormously influential on pressing for the development of procurement policies inside of organizations. So if you think of, again, in universities, because it's the context which I'm most familiar with, is student groups, a champion inside of the administration will hear the student groups, and then there will be a development of some kind of purchasing policy because of that. So in terms of thinking about developing purchasing policies, which I know David's going to talk about a bit as a tool of a people-centered economy and thinking about internalizing social economy organizations within them, the movement nature of those changes and the movement ability to create those changes is hugely important. So I really want to stay to my 10 minutes time, and so I'm going to have to go over relatively briefly the other details which people can get in the final paper, which will be ready for, as I said, the Ottawa event. But what we also want to look at is the history. So out of this research, we asked the question, how did purchasing policies develop this way? Why have they become siloed? Why have purchasing policies not caught on the way that we might think that they should have? And we'd go back in history and trace sort of what we call the movement-based approach to purchasing policies, which tries to connect historical movements for more ethical economic activity to purchasing policies. And we pick up a whole bunch of different strands, some of which I put in point form in the paper, which is on the wiki, which you can look at, but an example being like Gandhi's salt movement in India, but the trying to nationalize the production of salt, so to speak, within the British Empire. And also, of course, most importantly, in the post-World War II context, all of the movements towards, for example, natural food or environmental movements or the civil rights movement or alternative trading organizations, all of these types of movements have created to varying degrees what could be conceived of as purchasing policies. But what we really wanted to get to was to discuss why this idea of purchasing policies now, and in our research, the resistance that administrations and organizations had to developing purchasing policies, how that idea had developed. And we wanted to make the argument that essentially purchasing policies are based on values and people's perceived values, whether organizationally or personally. And the difficulty of tracing or connecting a purchasing policy to a personal value is a link that's not often made by people. So an example from our research, again, that people say this would be good for Mother Earth. It's the right thing to do, but we don't have time to develop it now. We don't have the resources to develop a purchasing policy now. And so what we wanted to say is that we need to make clear, if we're going to think about purchasing policy, make that link between values and this type of economic activity clear. And part of the problem with that is that there's a dominant understanding of economic value in society at large, which our argument is prohibits this development of a more progressive understanding of purchasing policies. And we trace that, I won't go into details unless people want to ask about this, but we trace the problem essentially of the idea of individual choice, because one of the responses that we had in our research is that we can't pick winners was one of the reasons why you couldn't develop purchasing policies. And what the people meant when they said you can't pick winners is you have to let the individual consumer, whoever that is, make their market choice. You can't limit those choices. And we found that a very interesting problem because, of course, we're always picking winners one way or another whenever we have any social policy around economics. And secondly, there was an idea that you can't reduce competition. Competition always provides the best end goal and product for whoever's doing the purchasing. And so we wanted to sort of expose those ideas and draw the connection between thinking that way economically and thinking around purchasing policies and a people-centered economy and how difficult that link is to make. And one of the problems that we see when the prioritization of individual choice and cost are highlighted is that corporations, in fact, become the beneficiaries of purchasing policies rather than social economy organizations. And we give a couple of examples, but Starbucks, for example, is the biggest distributor of fair trade and gets lots of press for being ethical. Or you can think of the Forestry Stewardship Council or the Marine Stewardship Council as labels which are industry-directed and that have caught people's attention. And there hasn't been a corollary of a social economy label, if you'd like, developed around purchasing. So what we do is we conclude in the paper, not just leaving it at that state, but rather saying that we need to think about purchasing policies as playing an important role within a people-centered economy. And specifically, by focusing in on values, we think that there's an ability to open up the space for people-centered economy purchasing policies. And we give a definition of the social economy, and we think of the definitions of economics in that context. But essentially what we want to do is provide two policy solutions. One is that that there's an enormous amount of leakage, if you'd like, out of the social economy, because social economy organizations don't have purchasing policies or practices that connect themselves to each other. And so essentially the social economy is leaking constantly capital, which it desperately needs to develop itself. And you need to think about ways to make those linkages rather than leakages happen between those types of organizations. And I'm using here John Loxley's work on transforming and reforming capitalism to give sort of a conceptual framework there. And then the second is the need to be able to measure the effects of the developing a purchasing policy internal to that organization itself, and measure a trajectory, as we were trying to do in our original research, between what happens when you move forward in a purchasing policy framework towards ever more ethical behavior and more inclusive to the social economy behavior. How do we measure that, and how can we give that value? And where elsewhere I've called it ethical value-added measurement systems, where we're actually looking at the social that is created by these types of purchasing policies. So what in the end we conclude is that the basic procurement or purchasing policies, and that word I've been asked lots, I'm using those interchangeably, but when we're talking about procurement policies, we're not trying to critique existing ones or say that they've been bad or critique labels, but rather argue that for them to be effectively instituted within a people-centered economy or the social economy, we need to think of internalizing those policies between organizations and highlighting the values that are delivered by social economy organizations in purchasing policies to encourage their wider adaptation. And that's it. On to David.
Thank you very much, JJ, for and thank you very much for covering that so quickly and staying on time. I just want to do a reminder to everyone before I introduce David. Throughout the call, if you'd like to direct a question or a comment to one of the speakers, simply type question if you're in the chat room, and then I'll be reading those questions after David is through his presentation. If you're not able to access the chat room, then there will be an opportunity to pose your question in person. So on to our second presenter. David LePage is the Program Manager of Enterprising Nonprofits. So welcome, David.
Hey, thank you, Lou. And JJ, thanks very much. Great foundation. I think I'll build on some of what JJ talked about and sort of realizing that the marketplace is this complex set of relationships that's based on the delivery of sales of goods and services in exchange for money or some other barter agreement. And we're all participating in it. I mean, we're all, as individuals and organizations and businesses, we purchase things every day. We purchase office supplies, printing, courier, catering, coffee. And those are just the things that I realized that I was purchasing today. So I think when you start to think about the fact that we're all involved in this marketplace, we're either on the supply side, the product or service provider, or we're on the other side, the demand side, the purchaser. And the premise of my analysis in the paper that we produced for the summit is that realizing and then taking advantage of the opportunities available in the marketplace is, in fact, one of the key factors in the creation of a people-centered economy. Because the fact is, whether intentional or unintentional, every purchase has a ripple effect and multipliers. When a purchase is made, it creates impacts, such as who gets employed, where production takes place, or how money circulates. And it's interesting because, as JJ pointed out, in the siloed current marketplace, it's basically based on just two factors, the price and the quality of the product. But when we start to look at a people-centered economy, the exchange has to be based upon a blended value that not only includes price and product quality, but also the creation of social, environmental, and cultural values. So I really think that with intentional purchasing that's targeted to social economy businesses, we will create the desired impacts for a people-centered economy and support healthy and sustainable communities. So purposeful purchasing is key to leveraging the market multipliers to affect an economy that supports positive community development impact. And there's, you know, like JJ mentioned, there's some things that we're pretty familiar with in this thing, such as the fair trade and the direct trade movements, the growing number of buy local initiatives. And this trend toward intentional demand for sustainable projects, which requires that blended financial, environmental, and social values, actually offers the social economy enterprises a tremendous market opportunity, because this is a scenario they represent. They are the ideal supplier in a blended value bottom line. I mean, some examples of where we see this trend moving is, JJ mentioned the university sector and how some of the student pressure, the no sweat movement, has increased. Some of it's been from consumer pressure. But we're starting to see some incorporation of corporate social responsibility applications into supply chain decisions. Like in Vancouver, we have a SAP, a large software company, that buys all their catering from social enterprises. And so that really is a question of how does the private sector use their purchasing power directed toward the social economy businesses to get quality product, competitive price, social value. In the nonprofit sector, I think JJ is absolutely correct. We really are not taking advantage of all the purchasing we're doing by not intentionally putting it towards social economy businesses. And in government, I think the real taxpayer return on investment would be to have the government use their purchasing to contribute to sustainable economies. We've got some examples in Canada where, you know, like the Manitoba CED lens on purchasing. Or some years ago, the city of Vancouver put in a sustainable purchasing policy, and now we're trying to get that revitalized. In the poverty reduction plan for Ontario, they talked about how to use social enterprise purchasing as a tool for poverty reduction. So we're starting to get some discussion around it. I don't think we've actually gotten a lot of traction. I think we're still in the sort of a Wizard of Oz kind of thing, where there's a lot of discussion but not a lot of positive activity. So I actually have like four recommendations that I think will help influence this movement. And one is, I think we have to build the capacity of the social economy suppliers to meet the growing opportunities. We really need to enhance the business skills and support suppliers in scaling up for market. Two, we have to create an environment that actually encourages and supports private sector, nonprofits, and government procurement policy and practice for purchasing from social economy businesses. Things like weighting social value in bid criteria. Some of you may have watched the Olympics, and the flowers that were handed out to the medal winners were produced by a social enterprise that trains women coming out of prison. But the only reason that contract was won by that florist was that the Olympic committee put a social weighting on that request for proposals, which allowed them to come in with price, quality, and social value. And third, I think we need to build more engaged market and sales relationships with the private, public, and social sector. We really need to be aware of supply chain opportunities and things like the Social Enterprise Purchasing Toolkit that's on the ENP website. How can we provide, you know, and help create these relationships? And I think the fourth point would be to develop intermediary services that actually facilitate access to and increase markets. So as an example, Chantier L'Economie Sociale has a great database of social economy businesses in Quebec. So if someone wants to purchase from them, they can go to that database and find them. There's more groups like Common Thread, which is a co-op of smaller social enterprises that do sewing that are getting together so that they can have more impact in their supply chain. So I'm just going to conclude with the concept that I really think that if we can utilize the opportunities the marketplace offers, that really is a key factor in the creation of a people-centered economy. And I think, JJ, I think what you found in terms of things like linkage versus leakage and the silos of it is exactly the same that we're finding from a practitioner's kind of side of things. It's like when we go talk to a business and they say, well, what's the price and the quality? And, you know, how do we start to incorporate a value-based or blended value-based decision-making in supply chain? And I totally agree, JJ. We're in the social economy sector itself is in a place to lead that. So I'll just conclude with that and back to you, Lou.
Thanks very much, David. I'm just monitoring the chat room here, and what I have are a couple of comments, no questions yet. So what I'll do is I'll just read the comments, and if you'd like to respond, either of you, JJ or David, to the comments. The first comment coming from Maddie is one way to bring values, or at least values-based goals, into the practice of procurement is to have outcomes based on requests for proposals. So just any response to that from either of you, JJ or David?
I think that Maddie's correct, but one of the problems that we found in a lot of research we did last year, and I don't know, JJ, if you found this, is there are oftentimes policies in place, but in fact the rewards for the procurement people is really based on saving money.
Yeah.
So if you can have this lovely policy that is an ethical policy and a fair trade policy, but if all the rewards to the purchasers are based on only budget outcomes, then we're not going to see change in behavior. And it's interesting because in June I'm actually doing a presentation to the Purchasing Managers Association of Canada conference, and I don't think if I had proposed this workshop 3 years ago, we would have had the opportunity, but I'm actually presenting on integrating social values into the supply chain, which I think they're trying to figure out, but it's going to take a pretty comprehensive change in behavior.
Yeah, can I interject here?
Sure. Is this Maddie?
This is Maddie, yes. Yes. The example I had in mind, actually, was that here in BC, we've transitioned from 10, 12 years ago, having had a NDP government to a Liberal, very right-wing government. And one of the things that became noteworthy in purchasing practices, the Liberal government came in and started BC Bid, and we moved to an integrated government-wide purchasing process. And as part of that, funding for example, settlement and immigration societies and services were put on to a strictly competitive basis. And it just didn't work. They weren't interested in competing, and the people in government who for years had sort of been the stewards of these programs were quite chagrined to see everything going sideways. So they had the sense, they sort of backed their way into it. They did a review of their procurement process for the initial 3 years, which basically didn't work, and had an outside agency do the review in order to be at arm's length, and the outside agency came to the conclusion that the parties were speaking different languages. So they turned around and they took a bit of a policy approach to their RFPs, and they said, what would be the values-based outcomes that we would want to see for these services and for these societies, and then how would these values flow through into RFPs for purchasing And so that's what they did. They set the overarching values-based outcomes for the program areas that were doing the purchasing on behalf of government. And they said, you have to show us how in your purchasing proposals you're going to meet these values at the same time. And it freed things up, and it actually got the negotiations moving again. It moved things back on track. And what it has done, it has sort of strengthened in an informal network. It has strengthened the nonprofit societies that receive this funding from government and who then go out and also now do their own purchasing. So it's had a bit of a ripple effect. And it's just been sort of an innovative approach to take basically what were program and service area outcomes and bring them into the purchasing process.
Thanks very much, Maddie, for giving us more details on that. JJ or David, a quick comment or response?
Well, I think that it sounds very interesting. I'm always curious to see what values they put it they're using. And one of the problems that you mentioned right at the beginning, which is the one that I've encountered more, is that people speak different languages or words mean different things to people.
Right.
So it becomes a really another research project that I'm working on now is trying to build an understanding or a lexicon of these different meanings of values, because it often becomes everybody sees what they want to see in a value, or the values are not actually they don't play out in practice. So
Maddie, can I just maybe interrupt you here?
Sure.
And I'm going to give an opportunity to other folks to ask a question. And what I'll come back to Sandra's comment on the chat room maybe in a minute or two, but why don't we go to see if we've got any questions coming from our visitors from the north. Any questions coming from the participants who are across northern Canada?
While we're waiting for that, Lou, maybe Maddie can post for everybody that there's a link, what she was talking about, because that could be useful for people to look at.
You know, okay. Unfortunately, that link has been taken off.
Yeah,
they've taken that link away from that program area. I don't think that I can get at it anymore. They've been significantly revising the networks, and I don't think I can get to it. I've looked for it myself.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's unfortunate, but a great suggestion. Okay, not hearing any questions coming from the north, then how about eastern Canada? I know we have quite a number of participants from through the Atlantic region, so any questions from participants in eastern Canada? And if you remember, if you want to participate, you'll have to do star 6 to unmute your microphone. Okay, nothing coming in from eastern Canada. Then how about central Canada? All right, then let's come back to the comment that's been provided by Sandra. For those of you who are able to see the chat room, it's a fairly lengthy description of a policy that was put in place with the purchasing department at the University of Victoria. And Sandra, maybe you could just speak quickly to this point. Okay, well, maybe I'll just cover it. So what Sandra is saying is that...
Hello, this is Sandra. I'm sorry, I was across the room and had to run to unmute.
Okay.
Just to say that I represent Heritage Food Service Cooperative of Farmers and other folks who are trying to rebuild some infrastructure. And we've done quite a bit of work with institutional purchasing with institutions on Vancouver Island. And we kind of, the point about everybody having their own language is really, really true. The other thing is the legal framework that public institutions have to face also has been a really big barrier. Plus also, a lot of institutions have just done one big purchase for everything under the sun. And so it's very hard for small organizations to compete in that environment. But we have done this pilot with several institutions on the island, and UVic took it up and actually did change their policies. They now call it a quadruple bottom line, and they have are setting criteria for those aspects, environment, economics, social, cultural. And they've been quite successful, and Ken Babich, the purchaser there, has been making made a presentation to the last national conference, I think, of the organization you're going to go to, David. And there was quite a bit of interest. He's also been speaking to purchasers around BC about this. And of course, in BC, with the everybody's got to reduce their carbon footprint, this put it quite a bit of pressure, and as we can use it as a real tool to focus on local procurement. But to me, the biggest barrier that small producers have is that the demands for public institutions purchasing are so huge that sort of tooling up to get there requires quite a large cooperative effort, and a lot of people need to understand this other language, the language that procurement, and when we have so many other things to do, it's a pretty big challenge. But there is definitely a movement towards a more ethical approach to purchasing, and a lot of really good work's happened on this in Europe, and I think the work that you guys are doing through the Social Economy Hub could really start taking some leadership, and I'm really pleased to see that you're doing this. But as well as working with institutions, we need to work with our businesses to, kind of identify sectors where we think we could actually get involved in the procurement game. Because quite often, the institutions are always looking for a price advantage as they're building in more values. They will, be shifting that so that lowest price isn't the only reason they do things. But currently, low prices are a problem, and I think that small businesses need to go to quality and the high end of the market if they're going to actually succeed.
Okay, thanks very much, Sandra. JJ or David, what are your comments?
I'd like to say a couple of things because I think you've raised some really good points. But I want to start with the NAFTA, and I know Tilma less well, but last year at the Southern Ontario node, we had the Minister of Community Services, Ted McMeekin, who's no longer the minister, who was speaking on procurement policies. And one of the interesting things he said is that NAFTA only covers federal organizations. And as far as he was concerned and the McGuinty government, that provinces and anything underneath provinces were exempt from the rules of NAFTA in terms of setting up purchasing. And I think that it's really interesting that they're, at least for those people not involved in Tilma, that's the perception. And I think that, in fact, this is one of those, what I mentioned in my talk about the role of suppliers in dictating the vista of possibilities for purchasing policies. This is one where there's a belief out there that NAFTA dictates any organization's purchasing, and that's not true. Inside of Tilma, from what I know, the procurement has been reduced so that anything above an amount, and I think it's something like $75,000 for goods and services, has to be open, so to speak, for bidding, but open only in between the BC and Alberta. And $75,000 is a pretty large amount when you think of the silo effect of purchasing within organizations. So I think there's actually a lot of space there for flexibility for developing purchasing policies on a local level or, for example, in your case, a local food system, and the fourth bottom line, I'm assuming, is the carbon argument. So it's. I think that often we're too timid in the face of those policies, and also that we need to, as I was mentioning in my talk as well, the movement nature of purchasing is crucial. The no sweat policies, for example, were not seen as being legally viable or politically viable until there was a movement pressing those ideas. And I think the same is true here with purchasing policies, but more specifically with the social economy organizations providing those services and privileging those organizations because, if I understand again Tilma correctly, social services have some kind of exclusion there.
Actually, if you go to Part 5 of TILMA, page 18.
Okay. I don't have it in front of me. I'm going by memory here, so I may embarrass myself. But
no, it's absolutely true. It's a very important point, as bad as some parts of TILMA may be. Government procurement, some of the exemptions are from philanthropic institutions, from persons with disabilities, from a public body, or a nonprofit organization.
Exactly.
Health services and social services. So basically, a lot of the social economy businesses that are nonprofits are, TILMA doesn't impact them. They can call up this exemption. And I would raise, in terms of the request for proposal provisions, Bannock or the 2010 Olympics may not have, in fact, done a lot beyond like the lost and found in the flowers, but the policy precedent that they set of putting sustainable and social purchasing are elements into their purchasing is now influencing 2012 Olympics. I know the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow in 2014. The social enterprise organization in Scotland is on the bid review panel. So I think how do we continue to influence this?
I think you're absolutely right.
This is Sandra again. Just one small point. I'm not fully informed about it, but I do know there is a movement to actually create a domestic fair trade framework in the States, and I don't know.
In Canada as well, the Fair Deal folks from the prairies were trying to create domestic fair trade, especially around agriculture. That's the area where there's interest.
Thanks, JJ and David. There's a question coming from Doug, and I'm not sure whether you've already addressed it in your comments already, but the question is, how far are we allowed to build in particular values or expectations that might suggest it's not a level playing field in the face of NAFTA and TILMA?
I'm trying to think of... This is the problem with written questions. It could be how I'm reading it or how it's written, but I think that it depends on how you're building in particular values, and I think that David was pointing that out well in terms of there are exclusions in TILMA, and again, I'm not an expert. This is just from a casual reading of it, but there are exclusions in TILMA for things like nonprofits, and in the face of in NAFTA, that anything sub-federal is, as far as I understand, and I've yet to hear a lawyer, trade lawyer, contradict this, are excluded from NAFTA. So there's a big opportunity there, and I think it might actually be a dwindling opportunity, in the sense that the more that the belief is established that we can't do it, encourages governments to fill that hole. And I think that the reverse, and if I understood David correctly, I think the reverse is that we have to fill that gap and stake our claim in that area and say, actually, this is something that we do well, and we're going to build it specifically on values so you know what you're getting. But we need to develop some tools to do that well. And we need to also develop linkages, in my opinion, between social economy organizations to address the issue of scale that some other people have mentioned before. Because I think that it's like that old picture from cooperatives, a bunch of small fishes in the form of a fish eating the bigger fish. I think that's kind of where the social economy or a people-centered economy has to structure itself. And it has to do so by internalizing its capital and making that. So I think I wanted to address those two things, both values and scale.
Great. Thanks, JJ. David, any additional comments?
No, I think that's good, Doug.
So our presentation is going to go well, David.
So everybody realizes, JJ and I are rehearsing. are you at the May 20th event in Toronto?
I will try to be.
Right, so we can do there. And then JJ and then Brendan Reimer, I don't know if Brendan's online, he will also be joining us at the People-Centered Summit, where we'll be doing two lengthy discussions on this very topic and looking at how we contribute to the statement of engagement that will come out of the summit. And the summit is, I think Lou talked about it at the beginning, and we'll probably refer to it at the end.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to, I'm going to put out a request for any more questions coming from the participants online, either in person or we've got an additional comment from David and also from Maddie here for those of you who are able to see the screen. But maybe I'll just check first to see if there's questions from anyone who's online that they would like to pose themselves before I turn to this these two comments again.
It's Annie Lou. I have a question. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's Annie.
Hi, Annie.
I have a question. Hi. David, I wanted to go back to what you said about the challenge for nonprofits to think about buying and or their procurement policy to support other nonprofit or social enterprise. And I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions on what could be done in terms of breaking that pattern. Is it because they get good deals at Costco? Is it because they're pressed for money or what?
I think some of it is just unconscious purchasing. Historically, we just have said, you know, this is how we do it, and we haven't looked beyond product and price. And if we start putting another filter on, like which happened when we were doing the social purchasing portals across Canada, it was really sort of building consciousness of the purchasing decisions when we make them that we can look for more than price and quality. As an example, in British Columbia, a lot of the community living groups, that's the groups that are funded by the province to work with people with disabilities, they spend millions and millions of dollars on, you know, housing and fuel and shopping. They actually started to do what they call the purposeful purchasing initiative, where they're talking to all the suppliers that they purchase from and saying, are you disabilities friendly? What are your ethical components and what are your social and environmental components? And they're actually looking at how they can use their purchasing power, which is significant, to direct it toward disabilities friendly businesses, which in fact then is meeting their mission mandate with their purchasing. So part of it, I think, is how do you integrate your mission and your social values into your purchasing, and not only do it by choice, but I also think it has to be part of the outcome evaluations that you use within the organization. And you should be able to say, we spent this much money, what percentage of it went to the social economy businesses, or went to local businesses, or went to organic food, or went to, you know, local farmers. I mean, there's all kinds of criteria that can be set, but you don't have to set the criteria. You have to also use it as an evaluation of success.
Thanks very much, David. We've got one more question that's come in. This question is, how much work has been done to create a more strategic role for the social economy in the investment brokerage area? Investor Aid Co-op was established in British Columbia. I'm a member, but I do not see much popular role for this yet. And then there's a second question, or second part to the question. Also, in creating a people-centered economy, we need to restore personal accountability of investment dealers. There should be a criminal code rather, or it should be a criminal offense, maybe is what's meant, rather than allowing a discredited SRO self-regulating model to continue. So either JJ or David, any thoughts on the role of the social economy in investment brokerage?
Well, I'm in the process right now of trying to set up the social economy investment co-op in Ontario, and it's quite interesting because the financial regulator of cooperatives in Ontario, which is the acronym is FISCO, doesn't know. The quotes from our lawyers is that they are bedeviled by our proposal because they can't understand why anybody would try and set up a social economy investment co-op, which clearly is not bent on maximizing dollars for investors. And our idea is essentially that we want to take the unrealized potential of RRSP contributions especially by salaried folks such as academics, but other people, and direct that towards social economy, local investment, and make sure that money, which is, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars easily in a local area, can be directed over time towards that kind of activity, the people-centered economy. But also we want to ensure that what we're doing in that is making sure that there's a viable cooperative, and also a component of the co-op will be that a percentage, 1% is our proposal, will be directed towards quote-unquote charity work to be decided on the cooperative. So I think I agree with Manifesto's question. I think there isn't enough that's been done there, but I think there are exciting possibilities available out there to start directing, again, to the way I was talking about it, in procurement, directing some of that capital towards the people-centered or social economy.
Yeah, and I can. There's a couple other very good examples in Canada. I think one to look at is the New Dawn Community Economic Development Corporation, which really uses and leverages local RSP investment in local CED activities. That's one. There's also an interesting investment opportunity right now in Toronto with the Center for Social Innovation, which has issued bonds to help pay for the purchase of a building. So we move into sort of the ethical screening groups like Michael Jansi's investment and renewal and others. But it is. It's really kind of on the fringes. It's absolutely correct. It's not the mainstream activity or it's not really well accessible.
Great. Thanks very much, David and JJ, for your comments on that question. We've got one more question here, and then I think that'll have to be the last question. It's coming from Sandra. Are we attempting to influence purchasing because we provide social returns? If so, we need to market those returns to the purchaser. And so her question is there a strategy emerging around this?
Well, I can address it from the social enterprise perspective, is that we're really learning that you really have to be in the marketplace seriously with a good product and with a competitive price, and then the social value is another component. But the social value without quality of product or competitive price doesn't work. And we're just learning that over and over again. And so from those learnings, ENP is actually working this year with a marketing firm, and we're sort of taking up Sandra's idea, and we will be, hopefully by September, launching a marketing toolkit for social economy businesses, primarily social enterprise, because that's our specific target. But it is, I think Sandra's a key point, we have to be able not only compete by product and service, but we also have to be able to tell our story about the community value that's created by a people-centered economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also it's not just about marketing the returns to the purchaser, but actually getting government to understand the returns and the benefits that is created by these types of organizations. And I say that because the policy framework can make a huge difference to social economy organizations, social enterprise, et cetera. Just simple things like tax laws, or in the example I just used with investment, a normal business doesn't have to go through in its application. If I wanted to set up an insurance brokerage, it wouldn't take me more than a couple of hours online. But it's been 4 months for an investment co-op, and enormous, you know, thousands of dollars of lawyers' resources and everything else. And I think that looking at marketing, if you'd like, the value of social enterprise and the social economy, but specifically the social returns of those types of organizations to governments, so the policy context becomes much more forgiving of those organizations, in turn makes them competitive. And I think we need to flip that obligation around and allow more social enterprise and put more regulations on non-social enterprise, and that I think would level the playing field enormously.
Thank you very much, JJ and David. I think we're going to have to bring our session to a close very soon. We've got a couple of minutes left in the call. I want to thank JJ McMurtry, the coordinator of the Business and Society Program at York University, and David LePage, Program Manager of Enterprising Nonprofits, for their very insightful presentations and responses to the questions and comments today. Thank you very much, both of you. I'd like to thank also all of the participants and for their contributions, and would suggest that once more that to go to the National Summit Wiki page so that you can read through the original drafts of the various issues papers and provide your feedback. And as I said before, these comments will then be incorporated into the and reflected in the draft that will be presented at the National Summit. And just a reminder, again, the 2010 National Summit on a People-Centered Economy is Sunday, May 30th to Tuesday, June the 1st in Ottawa. I would like to remind folks of the sessions coming up. We've got four more sessions that will be sponsored. You have to register through Ashley at the Canadian Social Economy Hub, and her contact information is sekm@uvic.ca. The next session coming up is May 5th at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, so that'll be, I think, 12 o'clock for the Easterners. And it's on enterprise development. Then on May 6th at 9 a.m. PST, the focus is on international. On May 12th, again at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, partnership and movement building. And then finally, there will be a session in French that addresses all six topics, and it will be on May 13th at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And for those of you who aren't able to participate in those, there will be MP3 files of all the sessions posted to the session webpage as soon as possible. So thank you, everyone, again, and hopefully you'll be able to participate in more of these calls coming up. Thank you.
Thank you, Lou.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.